Psalm 57. The nation of Israel was a very peculiar nation. It was a nation led of God. In fact, that's what the term Israel means, led of God. He was their king. His law was their rule of life. But things got complicated when they wanted to be like the other nations. They wanted a king. They wanted to be just like everybody else. And so they sought the Lord for that, and the Lord was disappointed. Samuel the prophet was grieved, but as God gave them their desire, he gave them a man after their own choice, Saul, who was head and shoulders above everybody else. He was a handsome, charismatic, strong, and able leader. But he had one fatal flaw. He didn't listen to the Lord. He was self-willed. He was not under God's leadership. So then God raised up David when he removed Saul. And he was in the process of removing Saul, I should say. But Saul was very infuriated about this, felt it a threat. And though David did not do anything wrong or anything rebellious against Saul, Saul was determined to kill David. And we saw in the last time a number of Psalms revolving around David's difficulties as a result of this situation. And we look today at continued Psalms on that same theme. And yet there is a slight picture here of a change where David is expressing more of a calm sense of trust because he knows God's justice will come. And he expresses that in a number of these Psalms. In fact, in Psalm 57, this is called one of those do not destroy Psalms. There are four of them in the book of Psalms. The do not destroy Psalms are revolved around times, you know, in fact, in this particular case, this Psalm was revolved around when David fled from Saul and hid in a cave. And when you go into the story and look at that in 1 Samuel, you find when he hid in the cave, Saul, actually looking for him, didn't know that he and his men were in this cave and went in to take a nap, lied down, took a nap, didn't know David was there, could have killed him any moment, but David just cut a little piece of his garment off. And then when Saul got away, far enough away, David called out to him and said, Saul, why are you listening to people tell you that I mean harm to you? I don't mean harm. I could have killed you. Look at your garment. A piece is cut off, and I've got it right here. And he showed that to Saul that he did not intend harm to him. But Saul was a man that was tormented by Satan because he had rebelled against God. And so though he reasoned with David at that point and let him go, he again came back. David was constantly under fire in that respect. So the idea here of the do not destroy Psalm was David told himself, do not destroy the Lord's anointed. In the same way that now he's really turning it around saying, Lord, do not destroy me. You know, have mercy on me. Help this situation out. And so he begins with that expression. He says, be merciful to me, O God. Be merciful to me. For my soul trusts in you, and in the shadow of your wings I will make my refuge. We face bills. We face family problems. We face work-related problems. But I doubt that any of you are under a contract to be killed by the president. I doubt that any of you are running, unless you're super paranoid about that and you're under this major conspiracy thing that he's out to get you. But I doubt that that's the case. Now, can you imagine living under that or a real situation where the president is out to kill you and he's got all of his resources to boot, to follow you and to track you down and to make sure you die? With our technology today, that would be not that difficult. In David's day, that's what he was under. He was like a flea in the wilderness, being, you know, followed about, a pelican in the wilderness, he calls himself, a flea being chased, you know. And David knew, at one point he says, you know, I know there's just but a step between me and death. But you see, he throws his confidence back in the Lord, saying, be merciful to me, because my soul trusts in you. And that's the thing that, as David encouraged his own heart, we too. When we go through difficulties, we need to encourage ourselves. I love this expression, though, about the shadow. Under the shadow of your wings, I'll make my refuge. This picture language of like a hen guarding her mother, her little chicks. A mother hen there with her wings that when the chicks are frightened, they all scurry under the wings. You can't even see the chicks anymore. In fact, there was an interesting thing that happened. An article in Neo Geographic provided a penetrating picture of this when, after a forest fire in Yellowstone National Park, forest rangers began to trek up the mountain to assess the damage. And a ranger found a bird literally petrified there, sitting next to a tree. And it was kind of an eerie sight. He took a stick and he knocked it over, and out from the wings of this bird went all her little chicks. And it was a perfect picture of really how God, in a sense, is careful to watch out for us. We don't think sometimes. We think God is unfeeling. We think that he doesn't care. But in truth, he's very intimately acquainted with every detail of our lives. We have to have an expanded picture of God. And so David expresses faith here. He says, I'm going to take refuge, you know, under your wings until these calamities have passed by. I will cry out to God Most High, to God who performs all things for me. I like that picture. To God who performs all things for me. Isn't that cool that, you know, really, in fact, we've got even a more clear promise in the New Testament, Romans 8:28. God works all things together for good to those who love him and to those who are called according to his purpose. I love that because here is David expressing that same faith. He will perform all things for me. He shall send from heaven and save me. Notice the confidence here. He reproaches the one who would swallow me up. Interesting, this term swallowed up. Obviously, you wouldn't go next door to your neighbors and barbecue him on your charcoal grill. You wouldn't think of having someone to eat and actually literally swallow them. But you know what? In a real way, what do we do oftentimes with our words? We can slice people up. We can chew them up. We can really slander, we can gossip, we can backbite, and we can really harm others in the same way as if we just swallowed them up. And this is the expression. God shall send forth his mercy and his truth, David says. Despite the situation, David is expressing confidence. Now, notice what he says about this. He says, my soul is among lions. I lie among the sons of men who are set on fire. The idea of consuming. He says, whose teeth are spears and arrows, and their tongue a sharp sword. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be above the earth. So this refrain comes after this expression of his soul is among the lions. Now, Jesus experienced that too. Here he came and lived a perfect life. Never did any harm, only did good. What about doing good? Preaching and teaching the kingdom of God, healing all kinds of diseases and touching people's lives in a profound way. Never harmed anyone. And yet they sought vigorously to kill him. Now we know it was for envy that they delivered him up. In the same way Saul was seeking after David was because of envy, because he heard the songs about David that he killed tens of thousands of enemies and Saul only thousands. It's amazing the power of envy. But like this, Jesus was among the lions, consuming lions, teeth like spears and arrows, wagging their tongues at them. But David says, be exalted, O God. Now verse 6, notice, he says, they have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They have dug a pit before me. But notice the outcome. Into the midst of it, they themselves have fallen. You know, poetic justice from God's standpoint, though it does not seem to come speedily, God has ways of turning things around, taking care of the situation. I was greatly encouraged by a news item that happened to a Calvary chapel in San Diego. Actually, Mission Valley Christian Fellowship, which is affiliated with the Calvary's. The pastor there is on our Calvary list server, the senior pastors. And he had, for the Christmas holidays, contracted with a company to put the signs up on 158 bus shelters. And the sign was, it's kind of a display. It basically says that Jesus is the gift that keeps on forgiving. And then a little thing at the bottom of the webpage, you know, JesusGift.com. So they put this up on 158 signs and some billboards around San Diego. Well, the Metropolitan Transit Development Board threatened to sue the company who put them up because they felt it was offensive to others. And so this whole thing came. Now, without ever bringing this to court or anything, this got known in the news media. The news media picked it up. And this is just all in a matter of days, how God answers, because we were all praying for this as pastors. The MTDB, who threatened to sue this company, changed their tune and actually apologized to the church for making them take them down and authorized them to be able to be put back up, and they're going to reevaluate that policy. And God just opened a neat door. But not only that, Peter Jennings is doing a major news thing on subjects similar to this. And they're going to run a national story, and they're going to invite possibly this whole thing to be a part of that story where it's going to be seen in almost 12 million homes. So God has ways of turning things around when you put your trust in Him. And that's really the encouragement here. David, you know, is putting it back to the Lord that he knows justice will come and he's confident in that. And he says, my heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast, meaning firm, established, directed rightly. That's something that I think is something that we really need to evaluate for our own lives. Is our heart steadfast? Have we come to a place where we're fixed in our purpose and determination to follow the Lord? Not like the devotion of many which goes away like the morning dew. But a true heart that no matter how hard it gets, no matter how tough it gets, we're continually to go. We're ready. We're fixed. We're steadfast. Perhaps it's when our hearts are fixed on God, when things begin to make sense. Perhaps when we really fix our heart upon the Lord, then things come together. But there are times it's hard to be resolute to do this. There are difficult times when we have the intrusion of business and we have the difficulties of life facing us. And it's hard. Sometimes people wonder, how can you keep your mind fixed on Him? The psalmist says and the prophet says, thou wilt keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee. But how do you do that? How do you keep a fixed heart, a steadfast heart? You know, I wonder sometimes because people say, you know, it's hard. I go to work all day and it takes a lot out of me. I'm really focused on that. It's hard for me to meditate upon the Lord too. But you know what? I have found that my thinking capacity is multiplied when I do meditate upon the Lord. Even in the midst of making decisions in the business aspect, and really in ministry, there's still lots of business aspect that has to be taken care of. And you can get swallowed up in that stuff. Becomes almost like a drug, you know, just a stimulation of all the thinking of the aspects of this instead of, Lord, what do you want? But we have to fixate our heart upon Him. You know, I've seen a good many people come and go Calvary Chapel. They started well. They delighted in the Lord's touch in their life. So hungry to learn and grow. They'd oftentimes sit right up in the front, just eager to learn and hungry after God and wanting to know His will. But then something happened. The Lord would come into a room in their life that they were unwilling to let go. Perhaps it was an immoral relationship. Maybe it was a secret sin, or maybe the pressures to conform to certain practices at work that they felt they couldn't get out of. Or some teaching in the Bible that rubbed them in the wrong way. Something, some stumbling block that caused them to lean more upon their own understanding rather than trust God's word and believe Him for what He says and to go God's way. And their heart grew dim. Their heart was not steadfast, and it cost them. That is so important for us. How steadfast is your heart? Because as David is expressing this, he has a calm sense of trust during this time of injustice. He's waiting for God's justice. He says, I will sing and give praise. Awake, my glory. Awake, lute and harp. I will awaken the dawn. Right now, David says, it's dark. It's a difficult time. But I'm going to awaken the dawn. I'm going to move it forward faster. I'll praise you, O Lord, among the peoples. I'll sing to you among the nations. For your mercy reaches into the heavens and your truth into the clouds. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be above the earth. And all this David made while he was in a cave, hiding. Do you see the faith that's expressed here? No, you don't wait till the answer comes to rejoice. You do it beforehand, trusting God is working together all things for good. And that's what David does here. And this is the expression. You know, it's really a matter of believing God is going to take care of us if we put Him first. Do you believe that? Seek first the kingdom of heaven and all these things shall be added unto you. Seek first the righteousness of God and then all these things will be added to you. That's what God promises us. There was a merchant who was once asked by Queen Elizabeth to go away on a mission for the crown. Well, when he hesitated because he thought an extended absence would hurt his business, she said, look, you take care of my business, and I'll take care of your business. Well, as he left, her interest and patronage of his business actually increased sales to a point when he finally returned, he found himself a very wealthy and prosperous businessman. Now, I like that picture because from a standpoint of spiritual, I'm not saying that when you serve the Lord, you're all going to become wealthy. You're going to all walk around with lots of wealth and prosperity. I mean, there are some groups that actually teach this and believe that, and they focus so much on the temporal things in this life, you wonder, are they planning on desiring to go to heaven one day? But the point here is I believe very strongly I believe very strongly that when we seek God first, He will take care of us. He will take care of us. We will not have to find ourselves in a bad situation, but ultimately one day we're going to see the end result is good, and none of us will say, gee, I got a bad deal. I can guarantee you that. Psalm 58, another do not destroy psalm, where David is expressing this. You know, he's crying out for justice and for his own situation. Here you find an expression here of a judgment upon the wicked. He says, do you indeed speak righteousness, you silent ones? Or literally the word is, you judges. In other words, the judges were silent when they should have spoken up for righteousness. He says, do you judge uprightly, you sons of men? No. In heart you work wickedness. You weigh out the violence of your hands in the earth. So instead of those people that were in charge in the power, places of power, instead of them taking care of the injustices, they were perpetuating them. The wicked, he says, are estranged from the womb. They go astray as soon as they are born, speaking lies. You know, you don't have to go too far to see the natural tendency of your children as they start growing up. You have to train them to tell the truth. They tell lies naturally. I don't think you've ever had to tell a kid how to lie. They learn it, just it's part of their nature, which is one of the proofs that we are born in sin. Are we sinners because we sin, or do we sin because we're sinners? Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Huh? Well, according to the Bible, we sin because we are, by nature, sinners. We've been born in sin, and this is really the truth of it. He goes on to say their poison is like the poison of a serpent. Notice, they are like the deaf cobra that stops its ear, which will not heed the voice of the charmers, charming ever so skillfully. So real picturesque language here, especially in this whole psalm. There's lots of metaphors here. But you picture that, you know, the snake is being charmed, but these wicked people are like deaf cobras that stop their ears and they won't even be charmed. There's nothing that can stop them in their wickedness. So David now appeals to God to intervene in verse 6. He says, break their teeth in their mouth, O God. I like that prayer. That's a cool prayer. Lord, break their teeth. Now, should we be praying that for people? Well, let me tell you what he's not saying. He's not saying, make them hurt bad, Lord. All he's really saying by saying this expression, again, it's a metaphor, break their teeth, break out the fangs of the young lions. He's saying, take away their power and their ability to do evil, to hurt people. Take away their power and ability. Now, I think that church, you know, in California was praying, Lord, break their teeth, but in a way not hurt them, but take away their power to do this injustice. And God answered. He broke their teeth. He took away the fangs. He took away the ability for that department to stop those billboards, those signs. He says, let them flow away as waters which run continually. The idea of just let them be like waters that flow. They can't have any effect. He goes on with another metaphor. He says, when he buns his bow, let his arrows be as if cut in pieces. So if you took a bow and an arrow back and you pulled on it and it's broke, it's not going to go anywhere. He says, let them be like a snail which melts away as it goes. So the idea of a snail, you know, which leaves its slimy trail, but a part of the snail is left in that slime. And eventually, you know, when you look at this picture here, you know, the idea is that the effect is not going to happen. That's what he's praying. Lord, all these people of power positions in these wicked places, take away their effect. Make them, he goes on to say, like a stillborn child out of a woman, that they may not see the sun. So a strong expression for the Lord to intervene. And then he shows confidence that God's justice will prevail in verse 9 through 11. Notice, before your pots can feel the burning thorns, he shall take them away as with a whirlwind. Now, that wouldn't have much meaning for us, but in those days, you know, you get the thorns and the kindling going, so you could put your pot on those thorns. And he's saying before they can even put the pot on, before they can really even get going with their plan and their plots and their strategies, he's going to take them away. As in his living and burning wrath, the righteous will rejoice when he sees the vengeance. He shall wash his feet in the blood of the wicked. This other picture of, you know, when you go out into battle and you have the blood of your enemies on you, that was a sign of God's victory for you. And here, this is the expression. You see, ultimately, one day, we've got to understand this. Though we now appear in weakness, one day we will appear with Christ in glory. And he will powerfully dissemble people who have fought against him. He will powerfully judge. Justice will come. And the righteous will rejoice. In Revelation, you see the people there, the tribulation saints who are persecuted, who are slain for their witness for Jesus. They're praying, how long, O Lord, till vengeance comes? How long, O Lord, till this justice is taken care of? And the Lord keeps telling them, patient, wait, wait. It's coming. Just wait. He says, so that men will say, and this is the outcome. Notice this. Surely there is a reward for the righteous. Surely he is God who judges in the earth. If you believe that, you're going to live quite differently from those who do not believe that. If you do not believe there's an afterlife, if you do not believe that you will face judgment one day, if you do not believe that there is a reward for being righteous and walking with God, then your lifestyle will certainly be different from one who believes that. What you believe largely determines what you really do. Now, this is one problem in this, because I see among Christianity today many people who say they believe this, but don't live as if they believe that. Well, actions speak louder than words. What you live is proof of what you believe. What you truly believe in will come out in your actions. And if you believe that there is a reward for the righteous, then you will day by day say, Lord, here's my life. I'll yield a little bit more. I want to be available for you because I want to lay up treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust can corrupt. That's eternal. And he is no fool who gives up that which he cannot keep to obtain that which he cannot lose. And you'll believe, if you believe that God is one who will judge the earth, that justice will come, you'll have confidence and not get caught up in the wickedness of the world. Not get frustrated at the wickedness and injustice, knowing judgment will come. You know, when I see injustice, it bothers me, but I have to keep remembering God one day will make that right. Oh, that person got away with it now, but one day they're going to stand before God. So I don't have to fret whether justice is met here on the earth. I don't have to go all crazy if the killers are not caught. Because you know what? One day they'll stand before God. And that is enough. And that is what David is expressing here, even though he has been so mistreated. Now, Psalm 59, to the chief musician set to do not destroy again, a Michem of David, when Saul sent men and they watched the house in order to kill him. So at that point, Saul was just starting his trek against David, and David was with his wife, Michal, who was Saul's daughter, in fact. And the men were sent by Saul to kill him, and he found out, so he got in a basket and went away. And what she did to give him time, she took this statuette, put it in the bed, and put goat's hair on it, and made it look like he was sleeping, and he was sick. And he told the men, look, he's sick. They came in to inspect, and they says, okay, well, they went back to Saul and says, he's sick. We can't bring him to you. And he says, well, go back and kill him there then. So then when they went back, of course, they found out it was a fake, but it gave David time to get away. But how quickly his, you know, I mean, how little things like that, everything happened. He says, deliver me from my enemies, O my God. Defend me from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from the workers of iniquity and save me from bloodthirsty men. For look, they lie in wait for my life. The mighty gather against me, not for my transgression, nor for my sin, O Lord. They run and prepare themselves through no fault of mine. In other words, David's saying, I didn't do anything to them. It's just this political situation has happened, and now I'm on the wrong end. He says, awake to help me, and behold, you therefore, O God of hosts, the Lord of Israel, the God of Israel, awake to punish all the nations. Do not be merciful to any wicked transgressors. Selah. So he's appealing to the Lord for justice. Now again, he's not going to take matters into his own hands. He's already shown that with Saul. He could have killed him when he had opportunity. But he is putting it back into the Lord's hands to fight his battles. That is so wise for us. When we're in a tight spot and we feel like we're being harshly persecuted, we can pull it back to the Lord. There are many brothers and sisters of ours in other countries that are literally dying for their faith. But you know what? The martyrs will have great reward in heaven. Those who are persecuted, God is going to reward them mightily because they gave their lives up for the truth. But David is expressing for justice. And then he says at evening, he describes them. He says, at evening they growl like a dog. They go around the city. Indeed, they belch with their mouth. Swords are in their lips, for they say, who hears? What a picturesque language of these, you know, uncouth guys who don't fear God, who are going around with their swords in their hands, burping up their last evening's meal, and, you know, just uncaring to anything about righteousness, growling like dogs. But you, O Lord, shall laugh at them. You shall have them all, have all the nations in derision. You know, isn't it interesting how we can read the newspaper and you can look at all those things and you go, oh, when I get done reading the newspaper, it's depressing. It really is. And I have to keep thinking, Lord, you know what? It's all going to be laughter to you eventually. All these things that are happening, you know, you're going to have the nations in derision. I will wait for you, O you, his strength, for God is my defense. My God of mercy shall come to meet me. God shall let me see my desire on my enemies. What a great confidence that he expresses here. Do not slay them, lest my people forget. Scatter them by your power and bring them down, O Lord, our shield. Interesting prayer of David. Don't remove them completely right away, lest my people would forget. Who's done that? If God took away all of our enemies immediately, it took away all problems, if he made life just so easy for you, how quickly you'd forget where it came from. Me too. I mean, I do it. When things are going really good, I tend to think, yeah, I'm doing pretty good. You know, I'm all right. And I forget where it comes from. I've got to remember it's the Lord who's done this. So he'll raise up an enemy or two and a problem or two, and he keeps reminding me I need to depend upon him. He says, for the sin of their mouth and the words of their lips, let them even be taken in their pride for the cursing and lying which they speak. In other words, let them be caught up in their own pride. Consume them in wrath, consume them that they may not be. And let them know that God rules in Jacob to the ends of the earth. Now we long for that day when the Lord will appear in glory. But you know, from time to time, God has mercy to show his glory, to reveal his power over the people of this world, to show that he's there. I think it's so important that we be people that are positioned in a place that he can choose to empower us, that he can use us as his vessels. Now, he can use anyone who's available to him. But why not us? Why not use us, Lord? Why not have the opportunity to be on the cutting edge of Christian ministry and serve him? That's what I would pray for each of you. That your lives would make a difference. That you wouldn't just live your lives unto yourself, because you will not be happy that way. To live your lives in a way that God can then show his power on your behalf so he can be ever more glorious. But one day, his glory will come and it will be seen very clearly. David goes back to the problem. He says, at the evening they return, they growl like a dog and go all around the city. They wander up and down for food and howl as if they're not satisfied. But I will sing of your power. Yes, I will sing aloud of your mercy in the morning, for you have been my defense and refuge in the day of my trouble. You almost get the feeling where David is hiding out somewhere and he's listening to all these troops looking for him, and they're cursing and swearing and going on and trying to find him and, you know, saying comments about him. And he's just sitting there like a hidden little flea. You know, Lord help. He says, but I'll sing of your power. For you've been my defense and refuge. To you, verse 17, oh, my strength, I will sing praises, for God is my defense, my God of mercy. What a great promise. Now, in this particular case here, we see this injustice that he is facing, and yet God immediately works in such a way that gives him encouragement even in the midst of his running from Saul. Even in the beginning when he's confused and doesn't understand, God gives him encouragement to put his trust in the Lord. Now, sometimes, and this is the problem for you and me, we're tentative to trust the Lord. We're very shaky. We're like, well, I'll try it. But I'm afraid. There was a man who came across a river that was frozen over, and he had to cross it. But he was unfamiliar with the water and didn't know how thick the ice was. So in order to not fall through the ice, he got down on his all fours and spread out very, you know, like totally on his stomach, and so he could kind of inch across the river. After about an hour of this, he heard a noise behind him. It was a farmer with 4 mules pulling a wagon across the river on the ice. Boy, did he feel stupid. And I think, you know, here's a good picture of how many Christians walk their life. There are those who are boldly going forward. Hey, they're confident the Lord has it wired. And there are others that are just inching along, afraid they might fall through. God will let me drown. Now, they're both going to get across the river, you know. But how they do it is quite different. And I think, how do you want to live your life here on this earth? Do you want to live it so tentatively and so shakily and you're not really trusting the Lord fully? You're not putting your whole weight upon Him? You're still trusting in your own plans and devices? That's a sad thing, because you're going to constantly be in fear and constantly be frustrated over situations. You won't see things as they really are. God, help us to see with faith. Now, Psalm 60, the theme changes slightly to a problem that happened in David's life of confusion, where he suffered a setback and didn't understand why. It says, to the chief musician set to the lily of the testimony, a Mitchum of David, for teaching when he fought against Mesopotamia and Syria of Zobah, and Joab returned and killed 12,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. Now, this particular record is given to us in 2 Samuel. But the interesting picture of this is this. All the narrative tells us is that they went to the north and they went to the south, and David divided his army to fight two different enemies. We get a picture from this is that they went together to the north, and it's kind of alluded to that something happened where David had to send half of his army down to the south. Obviously, the Edomites came in and they began attacking from the south, and David had to do something about that. But this is his initial feeling at this difficulty. He says, oh God, you've cast us off. You have broken us down. You've been displeased. Oh, restore us again. You've made the earth tremble. You have broken it. Heal its breaches, for it is shaking. You have shown your people hard things and made us drink the wine of confusion. Have you ever felt that? The Lord is showing you hard things that, man, it's just a tough way to go. What's going on with my job situation? I can't ever seem to get ahead. And my car's breaking down in the holiday season where everybody's walking around all too jolly for me to look at. And I don't understand what's going on with me. Well, this is kind of, David feels like he's done the right thing. He's honored the Lord. He's out fighting the Lord's battles. He's only by faith expanding the borders as God gave to him up to the Euphrates River. So he's way up to the north, real extended out there, in a vulnerable position, but trusting God. And all of a sudden he hears he's being attacked from the south. Well, he sends Joab down with the rest of the army, or part of the army, and just trusts in the Lord. But this is his difficulty. He says, you've given a banner for those who fear you, that it may be displayed because of the truth, that your beloved may be delivered, save with your right hand and hear me. This banner, this testimony of God's victory was given. And David had an expression of faith here, though, again, he felt it was unfair. He's following God and this problem arises. He's calm in the midst of that because he believes God is allowing this problem then to show forth his power. He says that your beloved may be delivered. God has spoken in his holiness. I will rejoice. I will divide Shechem and measure the valley of Succoth. Gilead is mine and Manasseh is mine. Ephraim also is the helmet for my head, and Judah is my lawgiver. So he says about the whole land of Israel, God has called and he's given special place. And then verse 8, he speaks about the enemies of the Lord. He says, Moab is my washpot. In other words, that enemy, that perennial enemy across the Jordan there, which is Jordan today, he says, they'll be my servants. Edom, over Edom I'll cast my shoe, which was another expression of victory over them. Philistia, shout in triumph because of me. So the enemies, David is recounting the promise God gave over those enemies. And so then now he renews his dependency upon the Lord. Verse 9, he says, who will bring me to the strong city? Who will lead me to Edom? Is it not you, O God, who cast us off, and you, O God, who did not go out with our armies? David is not frustrated here. What he's saying is the puzzle is now coming together. It seems to fit now. He says, who's going to help me? Well, it's you, God, who cast us off. You know, almost speaking tongue in cheek here, David is saying, you know, I felt you cast us off. I felt like I was being punished. I felt everything was going down. Well, who's going to deliver us? Well, it's you. It's you, God. God, give us help from trouble. For the help of man is useless. You know, you should underline that little phrase, the help of man is useless. That will come in handy someday. When you're tempted to lean upon the arm of the flesh, when you're tempted to compromise what you know is right in the Lord because you've got to trust some other scheme, the help of man is useless. In the end, it will not help you. But when you show confidence in God and give him an opportunity to show his power, it's then when he begins to work in a marvelous way. Through God, he says, we will do valiantly, for it is he who shall tread down our enemies. Help of man is useless, but through God, we will do valiantly. David, in the initial failure, actually learned something. Henry Ford said failure is the opportunity to begin again more intelligently. I think that's a good picture of failure. You're going to fail. You're going to struggle. You're going to strive with God. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to not be this perfect example of a Christian. And some of you maybe are even trying to walk on eggshells around unbelievers to try to be that perfect witness. Well, they can smell that a mile away. They can see that it's fakish. You're not being yourself. You've got to be yourself, but when sin shows up, confess it and repent it to the Lord and deal with it. Be what God's called you to be. And when it comes to all the injustice around you, you've got to come to this place like David of trusting God and casting your care upon him, for he cares for you. Remember, he's only looking for an opportunity to show himself mighty on your behalf.